It's Wednesday, October 25th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the bleepity bleep media men's list. Okay, so those bleeps were mine, but the list is real. We'll talk about who's on it and the consequences that they're facing. CNN's fighting back against claims that it's fake news using a commercial that might leave you thinking that it's the start of some crazy knock-knock joke. And we'll introduce you to ESPN's newest show, canceled after just one episode. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but we're going to start today's show just as we have the two prior, talking about the ongoing revelations of sexual harassment in Hollywood and now again in our own business. We've been talking about how rampant the problem was, and maybe still is, at Fox News, leading to the ouster of its founder, Roger Ailes, and its one-time headliner, Bill O'Reilly. Now we're learning that O'Reilly settled a sexual harassment suit for more than $32 million, and then, right after that, the network renewed his contract, knowing there was a history of continued behavior and of settlements made against it. Megyn Kelly addressed her own complaints, which had also gone somewhat unaddressed, in her memoir that was released last year and had this to say on her morning talk show on Monday.
O'Reilly's suggestion that no one ever complained about his behavior is false. I know because I complained. It was November of 2016, the day my memoir was released. In it, I included a chapter on Ailes and the sexual harassment scandal at Fox News, something the Murdochs knew I was doing and, to their credit, approved. O'Reilly happened to be on CBS News that morning. They asked him about my book and about Ailes, who by this time had been forced out in disgrace. O'Reilly's response?
I'm not that interested in this.
No?
No,
in
I mean, it's all
sexual harassment? You're not interested in sexual harassment?
I'm not interested in basically litigating something that is finished that makes my network look bad. Okay? I'm not interested in making my network look bad at all. That doesn't interest me one bit.
So this is a horrific revelation, making this settlement, then being re-signed. But really, is anyone surprised?
Well, I'm not surprised at any of the behavior around this. I'm glad that the New York Times has continued to do what it does in reporting these stories, despite all the work that takes to get there. But I'm not, unfortunately, surprised that maybe Megyn Kelly was wrong about the Murdochs. Everybody said the Suns have a different take on this. Well, they're the ones that signed off on giving him a new contract after they knew about these allegations from Lee's Wheel. So I'm not surprised. Why did Megyn Kelly not bring up this particular aspect of it until now? I wish I could say it was more than ratings, but I'm not so sure I do think.
Well, I think it had a lot to do with money because, of course, you know, she had settlement deals as well, and which leads to these contracts that say you can't talk about it, or the settlement contracts say you can't talk about it. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And I'm with you, Mike. I'm not surprised by any of this. I think what has happened over the course of the last couple of weeks with the Weinstein revelations and everything else is that now women who had been engaged in these settlements, who had dealt with this harassment, are feeling a lot more open to talk about them regardless of what they said in their settlements. Mm-hmm. This has given them an open window to actually go out and say, hey, wait a minute, this is a widespread issue that needs to be addressed.
I would say, too, before we get into some of the other issues involved here, let's talk about the excuses that were made by O'Reilly and by Fox. So first of all, O'Reilly said, I just made these settlements to protect my family from being abused, my children. You can do what you want with that. Fox said, well, we had a clause in his contract that said that if there were any new allegations that came forward, we could terminate him for it. And we terminated him. Is that an excuse for knowing about the old behavior and not taking action before then? I don't think so.
No, I think a lot of it goes back to ratings. I mean, he was their number one draw. And they were gonna do everything they could to keep him on the air for as long as possible. They knew about those other settlements because, you know, they were called in as witnesses in the depositions of many of those settlements. So to me, the problem was always there. They just chose to ignore it because of the bottom line.
I was also interested, Amy, in this whole notion about the legal pieces of this that make it harder for women to feel like they can come forward. The non-disclosure agreements that many of them signed when they made these settlements. And you can't really blame the individual women for saying, well, I've been through this already. At least I'm going to get a payout that's going to make me financially secure. Okay, I signed the deal. And then you also have these people coming to work having to sign non-disparagement clauses oftentimes, so they can't even be hired unless they agree not to say something bad about their employers if they ever choose to leave. So those two legal settlements and the fact that a lot of the attorneys representing these women, including some, you know, prominent feminists like Gloria Allred, they're getting their deal for their client. But what impact is that having on the rest of the women who are suffering through this kind of abuse?
No, I agree with you on that point. I mean, when you think about the staggering amount of money that we're talking about here, I mean, $32 million for one settlement, $20 million for another settlement, not to mention the ones that happened before that we don't even know what the amount of money is. To me, it goes back to Fox was paying a huge amount of money to O'Reilly, who in turn
was paying it, all out in settlements.
I mean, yes, he had his own book contracts, he had his speaking engagements, and he was making money from that. But if you could, I mean, you're talking about
to pay off settlements.
Exactly.
I mean, that can't be anything more than that.
Right. I mean, to me, it's one of those things where, you know, Mike, you were saying, well, he's coming out and saying, well, I was doing it to protect my family. Okay. How much money was, you know, is related to that, and the rest of it is your reputation and your ability to make even more money. Is how does that factor into what you're trying to protect?
And he does deny the allegations, but of course, in this latest settlement with Lee's Wheel, she agreed not only to sign this NDA and to also say in the settlement work that none of my allegations were true, basically, but she agreed to destroy all emails, texts, and other materials that might have been related to her accusations. So we'll never know for sure what happened. All we can go on is what the New York Times was able to cull from talking to third parties.
I mean, that's a lot of denial for $32 million.
That is a lot of denial. There have also been developments in the Weinstein case this week, some things that we should be talking about, too. One of the things that really kind of struck me is how we're beginning to hear from some of the big name actors, chief among them, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, who are coming forward and saying that they knew about some of the things that were going on, specifically with Gwyneth Paltrow, because of how all three of their careers were coming together in the, you know, mid to late 90s, early 2000s, but chose not to say anything, chose to look the other way, because their stars were on the rise and they knew the power that Weinstein held over him. How complicit does this make them in?
I mean, I think it goes back to the power. I mean, we've talked a lot about the sexual misconduct on the part of these individuals, but the reason why, at least if you go and you read all these stories and what people who are analyzing this are saying, is the reason why they felt they could get away with this is because of the power that they wielded in their particular occupations. And if you're talking about what's going on in Hollywood, he had a lot of power. And it was not just the power that he had over the women that he was sexually harassing. It's the power he had over the men who also knew what was going on and didn't want to say anything for fear of losing their opportunity. So I think it's that whole power dynamic that's playing out here, which is an even larger story that I think is gonna play out over the course of the next couple of years.
I appreciate in whatever context people coming out and saying, I saw something, I should have done something, I didn't do something. I don't know that we can kind of ex post facto go back and blame them. If we put ourselves in the same situation, we might come up to the same decision. I note, for example, that Amy, you had on our Links blog a post from a woman who was the first female editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she was sort of saying, well, we baby boomer women had all these advances, but we let the younger women down by not saying anything about this kind of behavior. I can appreciate looking back and saying, I wish we'd done better, but I'm not sure anybody would have, given the culture that they were in.
Yep. Well, and I would say, as somebody who came the generation after the baby boomers, and having talked with them, and I think each generation is making it a little bit easier for the generation that is coming after. And, you know, to speak for myself, we experienced it. We've had the conversation about what happened in the football locker room that I experienced a few weeks ago and women covering sports. We each had our own personal experiences and have a generation to thank for opening the door a little bit further to make it easier for us. I feel almost kind of bad that a baby boomer would have that sensibility at this point, that they hadn't done enough, because I would disagree with that. I also mentioned something in which I used some bleeps a little bit earlier in the show in our introduction. Not going to use the actual name of this list that's floating around now. We are a family show. You may have kids riding around in the car with you, but there is the S word with an itty at the end, men's list, that media men's list that's going around with some names on it, some of them very powerful in journalism and publishing. And we're starting to see that there are people losing opportunities, losing jobs, losing face within our industry right now for even appearing on that list.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's one of those things where, I mean, we've talked about Weinstein, we've talked about Bill O'Reilly, and there are others out there who are facing these same issues. And I think what's happening here is that we now have found ourselves at a time and place where people feel the opportunity to come out and say, we've had enough of this. And I think with what's happened in our politics, what's happened in our culture has allowed these opportunities to open a door, and people are being impacted by it in a negative way. And this probably should have happened earlier on, but it didn't, and now it's happening now. And so now we find ourselves at the situation. And you have some prominent people who are basically coming out and saying, hey, I probably did this. I'm doing a mea culpa here, and I'm sorry. But now they're having to face the consequences of that as well.
I have a really complicated response to this list. Mm-hmm. One, I mean, it was intended to be circulated privately among women complaining about men in media who bad behavior across the spectrum. And there was even a disclaimer, should it ever get out there on the list, that says, you know, these are allegations and rumors, take it all with a grain of salt. If you know somebody that's on this list, don't freak out about it. On the other hand, in some ways, it does concern me, because it kind of reminds me of a process question that we have about the way sexual misconduct allegations are handled on college campuses. I mean, the burden of proof there is not what it would be in a criminal situation, or certainly the burden of proof for some person who's named on this list, whether they actually are guilty or not, is troubling. But it's also troubling that women feel the necessity to circulate a list like this because of all the things we've been mm-hmm. saying previously on this show. The culture is so toxic, the inability to be heard, the legal impediments are in your way, that if you feel like this is the only way I can have some power in this situation, that's really troubling too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sometimes when you want to get a point across, less is more.
This is an apple. Some people might try to tell you that it's a banana. They might scream banana, banana, banana over and over and over again. They might put banana in all caps. You might even start to believe that this is a banana. But it's not. This is an apple.
Then the words facts first and CNN's logo appear on screen. The message here is about as subtle as a hit on the head with a hammer.
I mean, to me, it's just perfect. I mean, it says what needs to be said. It's a clever non-confrontation. Doesn't even name the president or anybody else in it, but it's obvious to anyone who sees it what the message is all about. I read on one of the posts that this is the first of these commercials in a campaign, so we may be seeing some more as well. I think it really hits the mark with the message they're trying to sell.
Yeah, you know, I think first, you know, we were talking back, I mean, I think it was right after either the election mm-hmm. or the inauguration yeah. when the Washington Post came out with its democracy.
Democracy dies in the darkness.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about that, and now we move into this. And I think it's one of those instances where you have a media organization that has been openly engaging with the president on what's fact and what's not, and the president coming out in tweets and even in person basically saying that CNN is a threat to democracy and is against the people and all these things. And they're fighting back and basically saying, look, facts are facts. And we're going to come up with ingenious ways to show that this is what we are doing. We are going to be a fact-based news organization. Now, the problem with that is that when you look at some of their primetime, it's more opinion mm-hmm. than it is fact, and that can kind of create some conflict there.
Yeah, I'd be curious what you think about this pushback like by a lot of people on social media talking about banana truthers. CNN puts on these same people that accuse them of fake news. They put them on the air and give them lots of time to spew this kind of hate.
And that's why I think they're going to have some issues.
Okay, well, I'm going to admit, when I first started researching this next topic, I had to call my dad and ask him whether they've been talking about this on sports talk radio, because I'm sorry, I had no idea this was a thing. Until it wasn't. Take a listen to this. The open of a show on, wait for it, ESPN.
Welcome to the Barstool Van Talk Studio. This is the place we're gonna be when we don't wanna be in the van anymore, / it breaks down. And as you can see, we have not really moved in yet.
So minimalist.
We got a lot to go.
We are bloggers, we come from the internet. This has like a mom's basement kind of feel. We're gonna add to this set as the show goes on, as long as we don't get canceled.
I think the closest thing to compare Barstool Van Talk to is maybe a Sporto's version of Wayne's World. Two of the broiest bros who go back and forth between the back of a passenger van and a set that looks like someone's basement, talking about sports in the most bizarre ways possible, and shock of all shocks, after one episode, which aired at 1 a.m. on ESPN2, the network canceled it. I'd ask you if you could tell me what this is or what it was, but I don't even know if that's a fair question.
I put myself through the torture of watching that entire segment that you posted on our Links blog because I hadn't seen it and hadn't read anything about it before now. And what a waste of 23 minutes of my time. I don't, at least Wayne's World, and again, I was younger when it was on SNL, was funny. This was not funny to me.
This was not worthy of
no,
our time.
It wasn't
Sorry,
worthy.
I've been thinking
Sorry,
about
it was
Wayne's
not
World
worthy.
Puns for the last 36 hours.
It appeals, I'm sure, to teenage boys and maybe the always teen bros that are out there. I mean, you had a joke about masturbation. You had a throw up gag at the end where they brought out an octopus out of a cooler, and the whole thing was just stupid.
Thank you for watching it, so we didn't have.
Yeah,
to.
I mean, I think that's part of it. I didn't watch all 23 minutes of it, but I watched about 5 minutes of it, which is about
more than
I could stand, and kept thinking the whole time, what was Skipper thinking? Or maybe he didn't see it. When I'm talking about Skipper, I'm talking about
John Skipper, the head of ESPN,
and I'm going like, somebody should have vetted this.
Was this like the Stoner sports show? Is that how we could describe this for people who don't know about this yet?
I keep, and the fact that there was a lot of information out there about this show and what it represents and the kind of backlash that they were already getting from many within the organization.
So this is, for the sake of context, we should back it up a little bit and offer some. Barstool Van Talk is a very popular podcast, like millions of downloads on a weekly basis. I don't know, though, if it's something that just didn't translate to TV, if it's advertisers saw it and wanted to back away from it.
I'm not so sure we know what kind of audience it generated in one episode or would have generated.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we know whether advertisers were fleeing it. I think that because they got pushback from within their own ranks, including one of their prominent female anchors who basically came out and said, this is awful. Here's a tweet that they wrote about me. I think they couldn't stand the heat anymore because ESPN's had too much heat in the last several months.
But I think it was two things. I think it was that, but I also think it was a level of professionalism that the people at ESPN, those within the inside mm-hmm. of ESPN, those who were pushing back against mm-hmm. it, I think that was part of it too. They're going like, wait a minute, if this is what we're going to run, I don't care if it's at 1 a.m. on ESPN2, we're talking about a brand here, and if we're going to debase our brand with this makes no
Remember
sense at all.
Remember the stunt when they had ESPN Ocho? Like, that didn't even belong on the Ocho.
Exactly.
While we're talking about ESPN, it's worth noting that SportsCenter anchor Jemele Hill is back on the air following her 2-week suspension for violating the network's social media policy when she said in a tweet that the president is a white supremacist. A reporter from TMZ caught up with her in the Los Angeles airport.
After my Donald Trump tweets, I deserve that suspension. I deserved it. Like, wow. Absolutely. Like, I violated the policy. I deserve that suspension. you know, going forward, like, we'll be in a good, healthy place. It'll be fine. And
yeah, so you've
I'm looking forward to it. As I said, like, the only thing I ever apologize for is, like, I put ESPN in a bad spot. I'll never take back what I said.
So it's kind of the sorry, not sorry. She's standing by what she said about the president, but she's taking her lumps when it comes to dealing with her employer and the position that she put them in.
She's taking her lumps for what she did with ESPN, but the whole time I'm watching that, I'm thinking, she's going to do it again. I mean, it's almost like she's going to say, I'm going to stand by what I say, and I might do it again. I kept waiting for her to...
And it's no different than the person who knowingly commits acts of civil disobedience, knowing they're going to get arrested again and again and again, and that there's a penalty for doing that.
Right, right.
I think consciously or unconsciously, there was also this conflating of the two different things that she tweeted about. She was apologizing for what she said about Trump. She was suspended for what she said about Jerry Jones and boycotting the advertisers for the Dallas Cowboys. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that we've parsed out exactly what she's sorry for and what ESPN is sorry for.
But to me, this speaks to a larger issue that I think is finally starting to generate some traction within journalism, mm-hmm. And within those who look at the media, is the fact that you have prominent NFL players who are basically saying that we are going to take a stand. And now you have journalists who are out there covering that and saying, wait a minute, this has more to do with than just what happens on Sunday. It has more to do with what's going on within the culture, and now it is really embedded in the sports, and it's always been there, but now all of a sudden journalism has found it.
Yeah. Okay, well, there was a lot of coverage of last Wednesday's event on campus, the use of the MU alert system, faculty and staff preparedness. But I don't want to talk about that so much as how it was covered by one of our local newsrooms. KOMU posted this photo on its Facebook page showing the woman at the center of the situation being walked away in police custody, reportedly on the lawn of her Central Columbia home. The photo was submitted to the station by a viewer and credited to that person. This photo, though, has ticked off a lot of KOMU's Facebook followers and some of its viewers, who felt that KOMU's call for additional user-generated content or submissions from the audience was insensitive, given that this woman was at the center of a suspected suicide attempt, and that perhaps there could have been some more sensitivity in how that was handled.
And it was kind of a subtle argument, frankly, from the viewers. They weren't necessarily taking KOMU to task for showing the initial photo, mm-hmm. but for using it as a way to reach out to get more content. I'm not sure if showing the original photo was what I would have done. I mean, you can't really see her face. There's no other identifying characteristics. So was it going to be that particularly damaging to her and her suicidal thoughts? Or I don't know. But could have we told that story in a thoughtful way without using that picture?
Or could we have Probably. Told that story without even using that photo? Yeah. I think you could have done that. I do have some issues with wanting to see if we can get some more, you know, content that we could use with that. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. There's some sensitivity here. This is more than just about the fact that it was, you know, it was an MU alert and all these other things. I mean, you're talking about an individual here. You can tell this story without having to get it from people who probably don't understand the nuances and the ethical considerations that need to be taken into account before.
So give some
this.
Examples about maybe some of those questions that maybe take a step back and ask yourself.
Well, one of the questions is, you know, could this lead to some problems for her or family members later on down the road?
The number of the house of the address
exactly.
is quite
the location,
applicable, visible, I mean.
The location, her location, and all the other things. I mean, there could have been people who say, wait a minute, you cost me whatever, and now I'm going to try to avenge some of that. I mean, you never know about those things when you're doing that.
The image yeah. also looks like your classic perp walk yeah. that you would see as somebody. And, you know, to this day, we don't know if there were charges. We were told that there was going to be psychiatric evaluation, and that was the end of it. Yeah. Like, this was a sick woman. And perhaps we did just, in the way that photo was published, create that image, that impression of criminality.
I mean, there are some journalistic values you have to weigh. I think in this instance, I think they don't overwhelm the needs of privacy for this young woman. But I mean, we just showed the image multiple times in talking about the story. Have we caused further harm? What I will give KOMU credit for, and I know you did too in on our Links blog, Amy, is that after they were called out for it, they left up the original image and caption, they put up a separate explainer note, and they left all the social media criticism there for people to look
at. I'm with
too.
You. I do commend them for that, because I think they realize, okay, there's some other issues here. We need to sort of figure out a way to explain this, and I think the KOMU did a really good job of that.
On doing that after. Well, before we go, I want to talk about a trend piece in Politico that says millennials are flocking to subscribe to legacy news outlets like The Atlantic and The New York Times in numbers that we haven't seen in a long, long time. What's bringing them back?
They need the content. They need to read it. I mean, I think there are two reasons. I think it is Trump, but I also think that according to the articles in our Links blog, and I would agree with this, is that millennials are used to paying for information. They're used to paying for movies. They're used to Hulu, YouTube,
Netflix,
go down the line.
Apple or to iTunes and pay for single songs.
Exactly. So now they live in an age where this is the kind of information that you need in order to be engaged politically, culturally, and one of the few ways to get it and to get it in a way that you wanted is to pay for it. Now, there's still a large segment of the population that is getting this news and information for free. But now you're starting to see this trend among this certain age group, 18 to 35, and even into 40s, who are now saying, wait a minute, if I want to get the premium content, which is what I want, I'm going to have to pay for it.
I hope that you're right about that and that it's not just a fleeting Trump bump as it was described in one of these pieces. I'm not sure that we have the evidence to prove that yet. I do believe from our own interactions with our students that millennials, I think as a group, are generally more socially conscious. They're figuring out
also surrounding ourselves around journalism.
Exactly,
students.
But they're working this content into, you know, as you say, into their daily lives and how they interact with other people. But I still don't know what happens if we don't have an extraordinary news environment like the one we're in right now.
But it may be one of those things where your news and information is going to be bundled like everything else. So they may wind up paying for it in ways that we don't see.
So as you bring up the bundle, one of the things I'd love to see happen in a bundled environment, because one of the things that this study and this information hasn't gotten into is how that trend translates on the local level. Because again, as we talk about our students and their behaviors, I have the darndest time trying to create local news consumers out of them. They may be reading the New York Times every day or watching CNN or reading the Washington Post, but to get them to open up the Missourian or the Tribune or to turn on the local news is like pulling teeth.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. Local is still
going to
be. So
if we are talking about bundles, I'd love to see national publications perhaps team up with local publications and to maybe do it that way. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. Thanks for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. If you're watching us on Facebook, we hope that you will give our page a like or maybe follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. Chelsea Prebian and Allison Picorn are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks.